You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 30th of September 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Once again, I am very pleased to be able to begin the week with my co-host here, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm very well, actually. It's been a good day today. I've been out and got myself some exercise and things, so I'm feeling well relaxed and well exercised and ready for our chat.
Excellent. It's really stormy weather here today, and it's stormy weather last week in Parliament. In the last episode of Aryan Britannia, we were sort of trying to guess what the Supreme Court decision was going to be. And I think you really called it right there, Max, when you said that you thought that they were going to actually fined against the government, which was an absolutely shocking thing to happen. But that is what happened. And what followed that was an amazing day in Parliament. I watched most of it. And the one thing that really struck me about all of this, is the quality of some of these politicians is really, really beginning to shine through, particularly the Attorney General I'm thinking about, who gave a fantastic response to the opposition. And just the quality of his voice, the way that he broadcasted what he was saying, his hand movements, his presence. I mean, it was like you're in the presence of a top quality upper class Englishman there who knows what he's doing. And the opposition were just absolute rabble. And these women there that were attacking him and attacking Boris, and they had no presence. They had no character. They obviously had no proper training in actually debating or speaking publicly. And it just became so clear that these women were only there because they're on a diversity quota. They weren't there on merit. And on the Brexiteer side, some of the people we've got there, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson, this Attorney General, they're top quality people. They are the sort of people that you should be in the positions that they're in, don't you think? I mean, you must have seen it as well, Max. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I actually watched a fair bit of it as well. And yes, I agree with you entirely that the Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, was booming, and he was... He basically established his credentials as a big beast of Parliament. I had to chuckle when I read one of the sketch writers who sort of report on the proceedings of the Houses of Parliament, who described him as something like, there were words to the effect of him being like Brian Blessed on acid, you know, and that was how he described him. And that sort of description is very appropriate, and he came over with a tremendous amount of authority. But there again, I thought that Boris Johnson conducted himself very forcefully as well, and he showed himself well. It was a good performance in court, and the Remainers, who kept standing up and who were criticizing them, particularly, I mean, some of the women that were like getting themselves in a completely over emotional state, were the point where they were close to tears, you know, saying about how they'd had threats and how they'd been things of this sort, all that sort of thing, you know, that sort of dirty side of politics is something that happens to any nationalists that make themselves public figures as a matter of course. You know, if you're a nationalist and you stick your head above the parapet, then you automatically do get death threats. You automatically do get people who harass you all the time, and you get there's lots of different forms of harassment that you get, and we just take it on the chin because we know the other side are dirty. It seems that there are some people who are directing that same sort of a tactic back at the social snowflake kind of Labour Party people, and they're all whinging and crying about it, which I think is just pathetic, to be quite honest.
Yeah, it was. That was the thing that really struck me with these attacks, and then they were saying that Boris Johnson's language was terrible, and it was inciting extremists. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. How is Boris Johnson's language getting extremists ready for violence? I mean, what he was doing was referring to the Act of Parliament that they're calling it the Benn Act, which he calls it the Surrender Act, which it is. It's an act that ties the Prime Minister's hands so that he can't say, well, we'll leave without a deal then, to the European Union. That's all that he has said. And it's the left that come out with all these attacks on the people on the right. We've had David Lammy saying that Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg are fascists. They call Donald Trump a fascist. They call him all these names under the sun. So it is interesting to see that they are getting the same stick that we get and the fuss that they make of it. But just to go back away to the actual decision itself, the Supreme Court decision, what they did, they put the judges up above the government again, which you were talking about last week, Max. And the way that they did it, they reinterpreted the law. Up until that day, the decision to prorogue Parliament was entirely lawful. And what the Supreme Court did, they reinterpreted the law, effectively changed it, because that's what common law is. When they set a precedent in common law, it our law system evolves slightly. And that's what the Supreme Court did. Under their judgment that they made of that court decision on that proroguing of Parliament, every proroguing of Parliament of the last century would have been found to be unlawful. This is the shocking thing about it. I mean, it's a power grab by those judges. They're not elected. Nobody's looked into them for their political leanings. It's modelled on the American Supreme Court, but in the American Supreme Court, these judges are they're specially investigated before to make sure that they don't have any political bias. Of course, they do, but they're specially investigated to make sure that they don't have one. None of that was done with this Supreme Court that was actually put into that position by Tony Blair, which shouldn't be a surprise.
And there's always been a distinction in the British Constitution between things that are regarded as justiciable, which means that they can be decided by the courts, the law courts, and things that are not justiciable, things which are not appropriate to be decided in the courts. And, if you go back to the Bill of Rights in 1689, ever since then, the proceedings and the conventions of Parliament have always been regarded as being not justiciable, i.e. that they are above the courts and to be decided only by Parliament. And what's happened now is that because of this this case, the fact that it's been accepted by the Supreme Court, and the fact that the Supreme Court have decided that, yes, they are going to make the prorogation of Parliament a justiciable thing, what they've done is effectively they have set a precedent now where they've only done it so far with this one convention and this one proceeding of Parliament that they've now decided is justiciable. But then that's the thin end of the wedge, isn't it? That's the that's setting a precedent now, which means that they could at a future date decide that other conventions and other proceedings of Parliament are also justiciable. And then we end up in a situation where the Supreme Court is then the supreme governing body of this country. So instead of Parliament being the place where laws are made, laws will be made initially in Parliament, and then if anybody doesn't like them, then they can apply for a judicial review of that law, and then the Supreme Court will come in and they will decide whether they like the law or not. And if they like the law, then it will stand, and if they don't like the law, then it won't stand. And so what we've now got is not the rule of law, but rule by lawyers, where lawyers are placing themselves, as I mentioned last week, and we've already agreed this week, placing themselves above Parliament, and are making themselves the supreme lawmaking body in this country. And as you quite rightly say, this situation has existed in the United States for some considerable time. And the result of that is that in the United States, the appointment of Supreme Court judges is a very political thing. And the politics and the background and the morality and everything else, and ethics of people who apply to become Supreme Court judges is examined and scrutinized in great detail before these people are appointed. And yet, if we look at the Supreme Court of the UK, apart from Lady Hale or whatever her name is, nobody could, I would bet you that 99.9 recurring percent of the population couldn't actually name another justice of the Supreme Court if they were put on the spot. And so instead of these people having been thoroughly scrutinized so that we know what kind of people they are when they get appointed, these people have just been very, very quietly appointed, and we don't know anything about them. And even as far as Lady Hale is concerned, you know, she was somebody who appears to have been a very distinguished judge over the years, but she is somebody who, up until this week, was virtually unknown outside of the judiciary. I would think that, you know, again, that if you stop people in the street, 99.9% recurring of people prior to this week would not have heard of her and would have had no idea who she is.
I'll just add there, you know, you point out there that anybody with a judicial review can do this, and that's another part of it. I mean, this was brought forward by Gina Miller, you know, this black woman, and that's because she could afford to do it. So in the future, this means that anybody that can afford to do it can, and is on the same political side that these judges are, could then override the government.
Yes,
that's
right.
The position.
And they can also call for the private correspondence and the text messages and the all of the various emails and things that are sent between members of the government. They can call upon those as evidence for the court, where those things will then be made known to the appellants, the people who are bringing the action against the government, and therefore all those things will then become common knowledge. And so it's almost like that they've created a kind of conduit whereby all of the most private thoughts and communications and discussions that have been held between members of the government can be broadcast to the world, where any nation, the intelligence services of any nation of the world can gain access to these things. And you might think, oh, well, that's not very likely to happen. But once it becomes apparent that that can happen, what you'll have is countries that are hostile to the UK sponsoring people to appeal against government actions in the future, just so that they can have a judicial review, and just so that they can then call upon all of the private papers and the private correspondence and emails and text messages and things that have been sent between members of the government, so that they can then know everything about it. They can know more about our government and the workings of our government than our own security services probably know now, which I think is an atrocious situation to think about.
It is. And I would just say, I think the Tories are sort of, or the Conservative Party are playing the Tory rebels or the traitors that have been kicked out. They're playing them at their own game as well, because they are, at the moment, they're investigating Dominic Grieve and some of these others for foreign collusion, for working with the EU on a bill in response to this Ben bill. So we could see them actually on charges as well, close enough to treason, colluding with a foreign government, which also brings up what Boris Johnson's response could be to that act, because there's this act which has been allowed to pass through Parliament by the Speaker, which never should have happened, because the tradition has always been that the opposition don't get to decide the timetable of what gets looked at in Parliament, and the Speaker overturned that, which was basically allowed the opposition to hijack Parliament, which has led to the Supreme Court. But because he's allowed that, they've pushed this bill through, which effectively ties Boris Johnson's hands, and he can't say, "Well, we're going to leave with no deal," unless he could do one of two things. The law itself, our law, is subservient to EU law, and the EU law is that Article 50 has been enacted. If we don't have a deal by October the 31st, we have to leave without a deal. And that supersedes any bill that the opposition have put through. So Boris Johnson could say, well, we're just going to go stick to the letter of the law, and we're going to follow through on Article 50, not on this bill that has gone through, which is probably why they're going after these traitor Tories that have been colluding with the EU to rewrite some kind of bill so that doesn't happen. The other option that he's got is to bring in the Civil Contingencies Act, which is why there's been a lot of talk of civil war, again, which we were alluding to last week, Max, about how that is the next stage. We've now got mainstream MPs that are talking about that. And what they could do is say, because we've got this fear that there could be civil war, there could be violence in the streets, we need to enact the Civil Contingencies Act, which means that all bets are off with all the previous acts, all the laws, and it means Boris Johnson doesn't have to follow that Hillary Benn Act. It means that he can leave the EU, and then he can take the Civil Contingencies Act off and say, we're not following the Civil Contingencies Act, and now we can follow Hillary Benn's bill, but oh dear, it's passed, it was a few days ago, so it's pointless now. So he could do that. So he could still leave on October the 31st, I think.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, I've been critical of the Civil Contingencies Act in view of the fact that it does actually give governments almost dictatorial powers. And of course, the Civil Contingencies Act was, I believe, introduced by one of the Labour governments in the early sort of 2000s. And obviously was done with the intention that in an extreme situation, it would give them the power to just act, make sort of sweeping judgments and take the law into their own hands. But now, because these things do come back to bite you, if when you start to prepare the way for yourself to exercise absolute power, it's very easy then to forget about what you've prepared and leave it there buried for somebody else at some point in the future who will dig it up, and they may not necessarily be somebody that's sympathetic to you. And here we are. We've got Boris Johnson, perhaps. I don't know whether he's actually sort of considered this or not, but it's been rumoured that this is one of the things that they've been considering, as you say. This act is now being considered to achieve things that I'm sure the Labour government that created the Civil Contingencies Bill had no intention of having it do. It's quite ironic, really.
Yeah, total poetic justice there if he does use that. And one more thing before we move into comparing Trump and Boris, the name of the sainted Joe Cox was brought up by the opposition when they were talking about these death threats that they get. Joe Cox didn't get any death threats, and it was nothing to do with Twitter, this assassination of her, which is basically what it was. She hadn't, as far as I'm aware, she hadn't been receiving death threats before that, but they linked her death with this criticism that these MPs get. And Boris Johnson replied to that and said that all these complaints of death threats, that's just humbug, and accusing him of encouraging them. And then he said, and the best way to honour Jo Cox's memory, if she was a big fan of democracy, is to carry out the Brexit result. You know, perfectly reasonable thing to say. And he's been absolutely castigated for saying that in the mainstream media, as if he was the one that brought her name up. It wasn't him that brought her name up. It was the opposition. And again, this is a bit where I think Boris Johnson has really shone through by just saying all these complaints that you're getting, these death threats. I mean, that's just humbug, you know, as a criticism of me. It's nothing to do with me. He's right. It isn't. It's been an exciting week anyway in Parliament. I think this week will be as well, because they've actually banned the Conservative Party from having the week off. All the other parties, the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party, they got a week off for their conference. The Conservative Party aren't being allowed a week off for their conference. And this was the other thing I brought up.
It's just spiteful, isn't it?
Yeah, because I said last week, I mean, even though they may say this prorogation is unlawful, it was only for 4 days. the prorogation, the rest of the time off was the time off that they normally have for their conferences. And what they've done is they've said, oh, no, the Conservative Party can't have the week off for their conference. But the rest of them have. It's ridiculous. I don't know if you want to add anything else to that, Max, before going into this comparison of Donald Trump and Boris Johnson.
Well, just to look at the sort of prorogations that have acted in the past, just reading the sort of Sunday papers, I sort of picked out the fact that the Parliament was prorogued for three whole months in the summer of 1930, from August the 1st to the 28th of October. Also, in 1901, it was prorogued for even longer. It was prorogued from August the 17th until November the 5th. And that Clement Attlee, the post-war Labour leader, suspended Parliament so that he could make radical reforms. And also that more recently, John Major prorogued Parliament and during his period of tenure at Number 10. And, you know, he's been accused of having done that in order to avoid the embarrassment investigation of a scandal. And so Parliament has been prorogued, you know, quite a lot of times. In fact, I think it's prorogued every year when they have the party conferences. But it's been sort of prorogued for reasons other than that on a fairly frequent basis and for all sorts of reasons. So to suddenly decide that Boris Johnson's proroguing of Parliament was, you know, out of order is just really, really silly. And to describe it really as being unlawful, to describe the prorogation as being unlawful, I think is wrong, because no law existed that you couldn't prorogue Parliament. So no law was broken. But it's been described as unlawful, and it's been treated by the media as if Boris Johnson's committed a crime and broken the law, when in reality he hasn't broken the law. He did something which was perfectly legal when he did it, but which has since been determined as unlawful by the Supreme Court, which is a different thing altogether, isn't it?
Yeah, they effectively invented a new law, although that's not the precise terminology for it, but that is effectively what they did. Deciding that they had responsibility, they had superiority over the government. In order to decide that, they basically, it was a power grab. That's all you can say. It was a power grab, and they invented a new law. Well, yeah, I know you've been comparing Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. Is that right, Max?
Well, yeah, it just struck me as interesting observing the way in which both these two characters are treated by the media and by the opposition in their countries. Trump, when he came to power in the United States, had all sorts of plans, you know, the most famous one of which was his desire to build a wall across the Mexican border. No sooner had he taken power than all of a sudden, all these actions were being taken against him. You had the opposition forces in the US trying to prevent him from being able to get the funding necessary in order to build the wall. There were all sorts of historic stories started coming out of the woodwork about him committing acts, misconduct in public office. All sorts of historic stories started coming out of the woodwork relating to sexual aggression on his part, particularly, you know, against women. This Stormy Daniels woman sort of suddenly appeared with accusations that she had an affair with him. He was accused of casual racism. He was accused of misogyny. He was accused of using inflammatory language, which would lead to violence. And, you know, snowflakes all got tearful and cried whenever he spoke. And there were accusations that he was under the influence of a sinister Svengali-like character of Steve Bannon. And there were all sort of campaigns and conspiracies that were designed to put every possible constitutional impediment in his way to stop him from being able to govern the United States, and created a situation on occasions which came close to the kind of gridlock that we can see here in the UK today. And it's no surprise that Boris Johnson has come to achieve power as Prime Minister and has got a populist agenda that he wants to sort of implement. And lo and behold, we're getting historic stories of misconduct in a public office coming forward that are now being investigated. Historic stories of sexual aggression against women. I think somebody this weekend claimed that Boris Johnson squeezed her thigh 20 years ago. And apparently it's taken her 20 years to realise that it wasn't very nice and that she wants to complain publicly about it. And I think that as far as these kind of things are concerned, you know, I'm a great advocate of, you know, that women should be treated properly and that they shouldn't be subjected to sexual aggression by men. But my point is that people shouldn't be allowed to come forward 20, 30, 40 years later once somebody's become famous and then say, oh, you know, that they once, you know, touched me up in a cupboard or something, and when there's no way of it ever being proven one way or the other. If somebody has sexually assaulted you, then if you're a child, you should be allowed to reach the point where you should be allowed to reach your 18th birthday, and then within 12 months if you're reaching your 18th birthday, you should file a complaint against that person and take action against them for redress. You shouldn't wait 20, 30, 40 years and then start making accusations against people, because, you know, it's just completely unfair on the people that are having these accusations made. And I appreciate that there are some rogues that have been caught out as a result of historic accusations coming forward. But there are also lots of people, Boris Johnson included, who, you know, appears to have been regarded by everybody as a thoroughly decent chap for, you know, decades now. But now all of a sudden, every possible thing is coming out of the woodwork in order to try and cast a sort of to tarnish his reputation. And so, you know, there have also been accusations of casual racism. There's been this woman, this case of this woman, Jennifer Arcuri, who was given some grant during the period that Boris Johnson was the was the mayor of London, and there were accusations that that he used his influence in order for her to get that grant, which again, you know, is another one of these misconduct in public office sort of things that's creeping out of the woodwork now. But that was 5 years ago again, and so the people have known about it, have sat there quietly not wanting to make a point about this for 5 years, and then all of a sudden they've suddenly thought, do you know what, I'll dig this story up and I'll publicize it in order to try and tarnish Boris Johnson now that he's the leader of the Conservative Party. Accusations of misogyny, accusations of inflammatory language, such as we had in Parliament last week, and accusations that he's got a sinister Svengali advisor, Dominic Cummings, who is the sort of Steve Bannon counterpart to, you know, that it fits with Boris Johnson. And again, there's all these campaigns and conspiracies by the people who are opposed to Brexit, the people opposed to Boris Johnson, putting every constitutional impediment in his way and creating gridlock so that he can't govern. And the simple way out of the situation here, well, but first of all, it's quite obvious that the tactics being used against Boris Johnson by his opponents are identical to the tactics being used and that have been used for several years now against Donald Trump, which shows that there is like collusion between the anti-Trump people and the anti Boris Johnson, anti-Brexit people.
Smear tactics, isn't it? Smear tactics. Yeah,
it's just dirty smear tactics. And I think that the public really ought to be aware that this is the case, and to deal with these accusations in the appropriate way, which is to take them all with a pinch of salt, really.
Yeah, I mean, going back to what you were saying there about these historic allegations, there's no real way to verify them. That's the problem. And I don't really understand this, you know, putting the hands on the thigh. I mean, quite a lot of times I've had older women put their hands on my thigh and squeeze my thigh, and I've just never thought anything of it. You know, it was so what? I'm not sure it's meant sexually. It's just something that some older people sort of do sometimes. That's the way I've always looked at it. So I don't really know what these complaints are. Go on.
I sometimes tell the story about when I was a very young student and I worked during one summer for a dairy, and I was delivering milk. I was the milkman. I had a milk float, and I can remember there was a particular school where there were probably about eight women that worked in the the kitchen to this school, who delighted in chasing me around the kitchen, trying to touch me up, and they were all cackling and hooting, and I was, you know, this sort of very sort of unworldly wise young man that was sort of running the gauntlet of them every time I had to make a delivery at that school. But it would never have occurred to me to make a complaint of sexual assault. You know, it's just something that I've laughed off over the years, and I laughed it off then, to be quite honest. But, you know, it's not the sort of sexual aggression isn't something that's only a characteristic of men.
Yeah, they make light of it, really, by, you know, or not make light of it, but they make mountains out of molehills. I'm trying to think of the name of the female journalist, and she said that somebody put her hand on her thigh, but there was no way on earth she would make a complaint about it, and she just, you know, she just wasn't fussed about it. And that's what I mean. You know, as I say, when you're talking to older women, sometimes they'll lean forward and put their hand on your thigh, but so what? It's, you know, it's not that important. There are a lot of similarities between Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, and particularly in the way that they are being attacked by the media. And they do seem to draw these comparisons between the two. And to be honest, you know, I'm quite glad that Britain and America are quite tight again for once. You know, I've always looked at it before as it's not good because Britain follows America into these wars. But to have Boris Johnson quite friendly with Donald Trump, I think is a good thing, and we need to see the country going in a rightwards direction, in a populist direction, and that seems to be what's happening. And we definitely need it. When you look at the opposition, when you look at the Labour Party and the sort of things they are talking about, they had their conference last week, and I watched a video with clips of various speakers, and there was one of them that was changing the name of it to reflect socialism. There was Diane Abbott there saying no ridiculous things. There was this other black woman there who was demanding reparations for slavery. Dawn Butler, she's the shadow foreign secretary. She's demanding slavery reparations and money to be paid out. But the worst thing of the lot, they voted to get rid of all borders, get rid of all detention centres. And they voted to give the vote to every foreigner that sets foot on British soil. I don't know if they mean people that are just here on holiday or anyone, everyone, basically. And no more immigration checks, no more hostile environment, no more illegal immigrants, basically. They just want to throw open the doors, invite the whole world in, and give them all a vote, basically, so that they can vote for Labour. And then on top of that, they said they were going to do away with universal credit. Universal credit hasn't been very successful, but I don't know what they're going to replace it with. And finally, is that they said they were going to get rid of all private schools, and they're going to get rid of all grammar schools, which means that the level of education is just going to go right through the floor. If you don't have grammar schools, if you don't have streaming, if you don't separate the bright kids from the not very bright kids, then everybody's just going to turn out not very bright, because they'll be concentrating all their resources on the low IQ kids that can't do any better anyway. I mean, just absolutely dreadful. It's the most Marxist, communist Labour Party that we have ever seen. And that's what they're going to be putting to the public. I mean, thankfully, I think the Labour Party are on about 20% in the polls. Boris Johnson is on 30% in the polls. I think last week was supposed to be the worst week that Boris Johnson has ever had, and yet he only dropped one percentage point in the polls. If there was a general election, I think the Conservative Party would win. And of course, the Labour Party are refusing to actually grant them that general election, even though it's a dead parliament. As the Attorney General pointed out, it's a totally dead parliament. It cannot govern. The Speaker has turned it over so that the opposition can hijack the timetable for the day and put their own bills through. The actual party that are in power don't even have a majority, because so many of them have turned into traitors and started voting for Labour, so they've been kicked out of the Conservative Party. So basically, the opposition have hijacked Parliament, the Supreme Court have hijacked the whole lot, and you've got Boris Johnson there saying, give me a general election, let the public decide. I think the public are absolutely sick to death of it, and if there was a general election, the Conservative Party would definitely win, and that would finally silence the Labour Party. But just seeing their conference last week, it was awful. Did you? I don't think you caught much of it. Did you, Max? Did you hear anything about it at all?
Well, I just heard the sort of general things that you've mentioned. I didn't really pay a great deal of attention to it, but it certainly appears that the true communist nature, really, of various Labour leaders is coming to the fore now, and it's quite. Quite worrying, really, and let's hope that the very large number of people who actually joined the Labour Party when Jeremy Corbyn became the leader of the Labour Party, let's hope that those people start leaving in their droves now, because I think a lot of them were presented with a picture of Jeremy Corbyn that was much more moderate than he's appearing to be in more recent times, and so I think that. Those people need to think again, because you know, if we have no borders and no detention centres, and foreigners are able to sort of come into the country and vote, what's going to happen is that the mass of people that come into the country aren't going to be doctors and nurses and the sort of people that those people that support immigration always try to present them to be. They're going to be unskilled people from the third world who are going to be taking the jobs of the manual workers and the working class people in the major towns and cities of this country. And you know, if anybody who's previously voted Labour is listening, then, you know, if you want your job to be taken by an unskilled person from the third world, then yeah, carry on voting Labour. But if you want a government that's going to put your interests first, then you've got to look somewhere else. And hopefully it won't be too long before we have a substantial nationalist political party for people to vote for. In the meantime, I would suggest those people, you know, vote for anybody really other than the Labour Party, based upon the sort of things that are getting through the Labour Party conference at the moment.
There was a lot of transgenderism that was being pushed as well, and saying that we've got to change the pronouns, we've got to change the toilets so that they're all multi-gender. Like all the worst communist Marxist stuff that you see was there at the Labour conference, and they were all supporting it. One bit that really didn't get talked about was all these accusations of Labour anti-Semitism. Which we've covered before. I know that's a particular favourite of yours, Max. You've been looking into that, I believe. How's the investigation into that coming on?
Well, having not got much joy out of complaining directly to the Labour Party, the campaign against anti-Semitism and the Labour the Jewish Labour movement have now appealed to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission and have demanded that they investigate the anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. And it was publicised quite recently that dozens of current and former Labour employees have now been ordered to give evidence to this inquiry. And so that they're being summoned to give evidence. If they don't give evidence, then the Equalities and Human Rights Commission are saying that they will obtain a court order, and if they defy the court order, then those people can go to prison. And so what we see here, again, as I've explained in the past, is a situation where there is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because going back to the Labour Party prior to Jeremy Corbyn becoming the leader of the Labour Party, there were never any accusations of anti-Semitism against the Labour Party. I can remember there was a chap once who stood up and who heckled, I think he was heckling one of the cabinet ministers under the under Tony Blair's government, and then he was very sort of summarily hustled out of the hall in a quite sort of rude and abrupt fashion by people who were stewards of that particular conference, and it was a story that was in the news for a couple of days or so afterwards, or perhaps a bit longer than that. But despite the fact this old boy was actually Jewish, he He didn't complain that it was anti-Semitism that was motivating it, which he, you know, almost certainly somebody treated similarly today would almost certainly do. But I mean, he just his Jewishness was just incidental to the situation. But now what we've got is a situation where, following Jeremy Corbyn becoming the leader of the Labour Party, and almost, you know, quite obviously, because Jeremy Corbyn is very pro-Palestinian and is very critical of the behaviour of the Israeli government. So we've got Jewish organisations in this country that have decided to smear Jeremy Corbyn. And so these accusations of anti-Semitism are flying around thick and fast, and so in a situation where there previously weren't any accusations, now there are dozens of these accusations, and of course you've got a situation where if you are a Labour Party supporter and you've suddenly got all these accusations coming forward, which many of which appear to be completely trumped up, then you are going to become antagonistic towards the people that are talking about these accusations. And so when you then become antagonistic towards the people that are putting forward these accusations, who in the majority of cases are actually members of the Jewish labor movement and supporters of the campaign against anti-Semitism, then the very fact that you take issue with these people is then presented again as evidence of your anti-Semitism. And so that would again infuriate you. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that I think ordinary Jews need to pay particular attention to what the campaign for anti-Semitism, against anti-Semitism, is doing, and what the Jewish labor movement are doing, because what the actual effect of what they're doing is they're creating lots of anti-Semites in the Labour Party where no anti-Semites actually existed previously.
Self-fulfilling prophecy. That's what it is.
Self-fulfilling prophecy. That's right. And it is for ordinary Jews. It is a dangerous thing for that to happen. And they want to have words with the campaign against anti-Semitism and the Jewish labor movement and get them to like wind their necks in. Otherwise, there will be problems. And it will be the fault of their own activists.
Of course, they'll never admit that. But that campaign against anti-Semitism, they got such disproportionate power. There was actually another news story last night that, or last week rather, that concerned them with Alison Chablow, and they took her to court for singing songs that mocked the Jews and mocked the Holocaust, and she was found guilty of sending grossly offensive messages by telecommunications, and her punishment for that was a year suspended sentence. And during that year, she was charged with not posting to social media. Now, social media, everybody understands that to mean Twitter, Facebook. I mean, you can type into Google social media and it comes up with a list of social media websites on Wikipedia. It doesn't actually call them social media. It calls them something else. So she had continued to post articles to her own website, because that's not social media. The only person that can post there is herself. So she continued to post articles to her own website, believing that she was complying with the order not to post to social media. And she had and the campaign against anti-Semitism complained about this and took the instances of her posting at her own website to the court. She had to attend court. She was found guilty. Unbelievably, she was found guilty. The judge redefined the word social media to include her own website, and she's been sent to prison for 8 weeks. And I mean, that really does show you the power that this campaign against anti-Semitism has, that they can just say, we want this woman jailed, and the judge will completely redefine what everybody understands social media to be in order to comply with the demands of this Jewish pressure group. You know, I think that's a really, you know, that's a really serious thing that's actually happened there. It didn't really get that much coverage. I think there was one Daily Mail article about it and one article about it in the Jewish websites. And maybe that's because they realize how that looks, because I don't think anybody is going to look at that and think, well, you know, your own website counts as social media. She'd even switched the comments off so that people couldn't comment on that. I think it's quite shocking.
I think that technology in this respect has advanced considerably over the years, and there are a number of things now that for which there are no strict definitions, and social media is one of them. And you would assume that social media involves some interaction between the person who's posting, between the people who are posting messages and articles on there, and that it's quite logical to deduce that a website that nobody else can make comments on, and where you're just posting your views, that isn't social media. That is, it's a form of media, but it's not social media. And so it was quite logical and quite understandable that Alison Chablot took the view that she did. I think that as far as the courts are concerned, when there is an issue where one side is claiming that something is social media and the other one is claiming that it isn't, it's quite right for the courts to make some sort of a judgment on this. But what they should then do is to just state to the person who loses this particular issue that if you, in this case, Alison Chablot, that if you continue to post on your own website, then we'll regard that as you posting on social media, and then we'll take some further action against you. But we accept the fact that you did it quite innocently up until now, and so therefore we will still allow you to retain your freedom. That would have been a far better thing. But it's a very sort of similar principle to, what's taken place with regard to the prorogation of Parliament. The fact that the prorogation of Parliament wasn't illegal, but has subsequently been deemed unlawful, even though no law was broken. So Boris Johnson didn't actually break a law. He just did something that was legal and which was then deemed to be illegal, unlawful subsequently. And in Alison Chablot's case, she has done something which she had every logical right to assume was legal up until the court involved in this case made a determination. And only if she then continues to post on her website should she be regarded as being in breach of the original restriction.
You've also got the fact that what she's got there is you publish things to your own website. Social media is a platform. And that's the argument that the social media companies make. They say, well, look, we're a platform. We can't be sued for the content that's on there. We're not publishers. We're a platform. And your own website is not a platform. You're publishing content to your own website. So the judge has basically overturned all convention there. She did request that they define exactly what social media is as well. She wrote to the judge when the original order was made saying, can you please define what social media is? Because I want to comply with this judgment. So she did everything she could to comply with it, but it seems that because this Jewish pressure group complained about it, the judge bent in their direction. Now, somebody else has been suffering censorship, academic censorship, was Noah Kahle. Was that under pressure from a similar group? Do you know, Max? Do you want to talk about that a bit?
I'm not entirely sure who the organisation was that complained or who's been driving the complaints, but it's just surprised me again that yet again an academic who's been investigating into the relationship between race and intelligence has had their research fellowship at St Edmund's College in Cambridge withdrawn as a result of complaints that have been received from various academics and various students. You know, whether somebody put them up to complaining or not, I don't know. But the point is that over all of my adult lifetime, effectively, there have been instances periodically of people who've been distinguished academics who have been doing research in other areas on occasions that's been regarded as being research of a high quality, and who then become interested in the relationship between race and intelligence. And it's quite logical to assume that there will be some differences on average between in intelligence between various racial groups, because there are quite obviously lots of differences on average between racial groups. So there should be differences in terms of intelligence as well, and for somebody just to merely research into that area, and as far as I'm aware, Noah Kahle hasn't made any sort of controversial pronouncements one way or the other. He's just attended a number of conferences, and he has spoken to people who have been regarded as being extremists because they are people who do advocate that there are differences in intelligence between the races. And but he's had his research fellowship withdrawn. One of the good things, though, is that he has appealed online for crowdfunding, and in a very short space of time, something like £82,000 has been raised for him to mount a legal challenge to the withdrawal of his research fellowship. So it will be interesting to see how he fares through the courts in the future. I think that it's very gratifying to notice that such a large number of people have actually supported him. I wasn't aware of it until sort of this weekend. Otherwise, I might have donated to him myself, and I may still do that. But when you realise just how much opprobrium is imposed upon people who actually who do research into this area, the fact that there are still people like Noah Kahle who are seeing the evidence and deciding it's something that's worth investigating, it screams to you from a logical standpoint that there must be clear evidence, because if there wasn't clear evidence to support the assertion that there are differences in intelligence between the races, then all these academics wouldn't do it. These academics aren't, you know, these academics don't wake up one morning and think, I know what I'll do. I'll completely trash my entire career by entering into a line of research that I know is spurious, just so that I can aggravate a load of these social justice warrior people so that they can campaign against me and make me lose my job and make me unemployable again in the world of science. They don't wake up and do this, and yet we see over a period of time, every few years or so, somebody else very innocently decides that, oh yes, this is a very interesting area of research, and yes, there is firm evidence that makes it interesting, and therefore I'll investigate this. And then they fall foul of the thought police in academia, and so it's deplorable, really, that this state of affairs exists in academia, where people, you know, universities are supposed to be places where ideas are battered around, ideas are discussed, that where there is discussion, people putting forward propositions, people criticizing those propositions, and then putting forward a revised proposition. And this sort of interplay of ideas is meant to make them seats of learning, where the learning that takes place is cutting edge. But you can't have cutting edge learning in an institution where certain lines of thought are regarded as thought crimes and forbidden. And that's the that's the issue that we have here today. And so good luck to Noah Kahle, and I will watch his case with interest, I think, in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah, I think I've definitely heard of him before. But the thing is, I mean, as you say, if what he is looking at is spurious, then why won't they allow it to be challenged? Why does it have to be banned outright? It's quite obvious that there must be something there, because otherwise they would allow it to be debated. I mean, nobody looks at things and just suddenly decides to be a hater. Oh, I'm just going to research this stuff because I hate Negroes. That just doesn't happen. It's the truth. And people that are courageous enough to stand up for the truth and investigate it and publish it, they, you know, they really do need our support. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that to our attention here, Max. Yeah, Noah Kahle, his name is. There was one other thing we wanted to talk about. Skin whitening cream is in the news, isn't it?
It is. It's something that occasionally crops up in the news, that people who are from the non-white ethnic groups, they very often will buy skin whitening creams that they use to lighten their skin, to make their skin white. And there are various chemicals involved in these skin whitening creams. a number of which are extremely harmful, a number of which that can cause cancer and can cause, you know, other complaints as well. And so, on health grounds, these skin whitening creams are banned, but they still, creep back in and there are, black markets, people peddling these creams. But it just occurred to me that there have been cases recently where, accusations have been made against, Justin Trudeau, for example. Justin Trudeau was accused only fairly recently of blackface, i.e. blacking his face up. He was severely castigated for cultural appropriation and for acting in a way which humiliates black people by pretending that his skin is darker than it actually is, although he only did it on, you know, like, isolated occasions. It's not something he did every day, but he's been like severely sort of castigated as a result of that. And we've had a situation where there was there's a West End production that is a story. I can't think quite what the details are, but it's a story where most of the main characters are Jewish, and where they the company that's putting on this production has chosen a cast which actually contains no Jews. And so what you've got is Gentile actors playing the parts of Jews in a stage play that's supposed to be about, that's supposed to feature a lot of Jewishness. Well, the production company and the actors that are involved have all been accused of Jew face. And they've been accused of Jew face by Jewish organizations, claiming that these people are culturally appropriating the Jewish characteristics of the stage play for their own advancement, etc. And so there is this sort of accepted premise on the part of the liberal left that if you change the color of your skin in order to advance yourself in any respect, then this is first of all a cultural appropriation, and so and to be regarded as deplorable, but also that it is regarded as being insulting to the people that you are trying to impersonate effectively. And so the thing that's totally absent in this sort of case of this skin whitening cream being found on sale again in the UK and in Wales is that nobody is raising the issue of cultural appropriation. Because if black people or brown people or people with dark skins are buying skin whitening creams so to make themselves look whiter than they actually are, well, then that is cultural appropriation. And if other people can feel insulted about the fact that somebody wants to look like them, then I think that by the same token, we should all feel insulted about the fact that black people want to whiten their skin up, because it's exactly the same principle, isn't it? And but you know, this these issues are never discussed in relation to this. It's always that we should feel sorry for the ethnic minority people, the non-white ethnic minority people who are buying these things because they're exposing themselves to cancer, but the interests and the feelings and the sensibilities of white people who are being impersonated by these black people are never taken into consideration. And I think that's you know, if we're going to have this kind of blackface, whiteface, Jewface kind of culture in our society, then somebody ought to be expressing their disdain for what's going on here.
You know, I've always looked at those skin whitening creams and thought, how can anybody white pick a partner that's black and produce a brown child, knowing that that child will then be spending a fortune on skin whitening creams for the rest of their life, wishing that they had been born white? Just the very fact that there is such a thing as skin whitening cream shows that Negroes want themselves to look as white as possible. And yet somebody that has a non-white partner, there's, you know, that child is going to at the back of their mind is going to be, you know, you forced me to wear this skin whitening stuff. You forced me to look like this when I didn't want to look like it. It's the same with the wigs that they wear. You see these Negroes with with straight hair, and it's because they're wearing wigs. And that's another cultural appropriation, is our hairstyles, and they have long hair, and they wear these wigs rather than having the natural afro that they have, you know, that's cultural appropriation from us as well. You even get them with blonde wigs, trying to make themselves look blonde. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. And yet nobody talks about that. Nobody faces up to that. Even in the non-white countries, the lighter the skin is, the higher up in the hierarchy they are. I think they call it colorist in Brazil. And they have adverts there telling people that not to look at the color. Instead of saying don't be racist, it's like don't look at the shade of color that the people have, because it's always the lighter skinned ones that are the highest up in society. I mean, we've been taught not to treasure our race and treasure the way that we look, and to realize that, you know, we have a look that the other races do find exceptionally beautiful. And the fact that these skin whitening creams are a thing, you know, that should tell us that should make us feel better about ourselves. I've never understood why blacks, you know, get offended by white people putting on this blackface either. It doesn't show that the white person hates Negroes, does it? It shows you that, you know, they want to dress up like them. They want to look like them for some reason. They wouldn't be wanting to do that if they found these people offensive. Let's not
denigrate all black people and non-white people, because quite a lot of them are quite happy looking the way that they would be naturally. But there is what would appear to be quite a significant minority that do want to.
Yeah, it's a huge industry. It's a huge industry, Max, especially in India and in Africa. There's huge, great, like advertising hoardings with how to whiten your skin. There are all these adverts showing Indians and Africans after they've used this skin whitener and how their skin is much whiter. Obviously, it's not all of them, but the fact that there is this huge industry in that, you would think people would wake up to it. If they've got brown partners, you're basically cursing your children to having to spend all this money on these beauty products, desperate to try and make themselves look white when they could have been white anyway, if you picked a white partner. I don't know if you want to. Do you want to add anything? Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah, do you want to add anything?
It's just that, you know, we're living in a culture where cultural appropriation and blackface and Jewface is always used to attack white people, but nobody thinks to turn it around the other way and say, well, actually, you know, you are committing whiteface, and you are, by committing whiteface, committing cultural appropriation. And if you get upset about the fact that the occasional white person, like a Morris dancer, blacks their face up to play a part in one of their Morris dancing productions, if you get upset about that, then, you know, we have a perfect right to get upset about the fact that you're using skin whitening creams and trying to make yourself look white.
I think we'll be waiting quite some time until someone in the media stands up and complains about that for some reason.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
Radio Aryan, for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.